welcome to the TripCast. This is Andrew Santum of the Meadows Center for Water and Environment at Texas State University. We may have a shortage of water, but there's no shortage of people that have an opinion about it, and no shortage of podcasts. Now here's this week's TripCast crew.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton with the TripCast for the final week of October. Joining me is editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
Is it technically the final week? I guess it's the final full week.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Final full week.
That's okay.
Right. Not counting the one
with
Halloween.
Todd will edit that out. That's fine.
Well, so the next week is going to be November at some point.
After Halloween, right.
PolitiFact would have rated that
half true.
Don't bring that's up right. PolitiFact on the podcast. You're bumming me out, man.
Executive editor Ross Ramsey is also here.
Howdy.
And so is reporter Kate Galbraith.
Hello.
Special guest.
Ross is in the Ben Philpott chair.
Yes. Ross is filling in for Ben Philpott.
Kate is filling in for Ross.
I mean, I'm the designated brunt. Is that how that we're going to have to make Reeve the designated brunt?
Are you saying
brunt?
That? Did you think of Philpott as the designated brunt?
He gets picked
on
a little bit.
I just thought of him as a jovial
Philpott
guy.
He's the Ed McMahon of the podcast.
He gets picked on a little bit. He's the Jeffrey Tambor.
And you're going to be Ross. So every time we make an obscure reference to something, you calm
so
us
I
all
move
down
things
and
along.
Explain
you're,
it.
You're in charge of footnotes.
You have to explain everything.
Ross doesn't move things along. Ross dives deep.
Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Great. See, I'm already the brunt.
That's right.
Didn't take very long.
Let's move things along.
What are
though.
We talking about?
We're going to start by talking about newspaper endorsements.
Oh, my favorite topic in the whole world.
Which we don't do, of course.
75% of my Twitter feed at the moment is me tweeting about various newspapers endorsing
about
various
Paul
candidates.
Paul Sandler. And oh, my God.
Yes, Paul Sandler, that nice Jewish boy who was endorsed by the El Paso Times for the U.S. Senate. Paul Sandler.
They liked him so much, they
almost
remembered his name.
It took them like an hour and a half to fix it. And, of course, my thought was, I'm offended that the El Paso Times editor doesn't follow me on Twitter.
Did they do it in print?
No, they just didn't. Well, there's no. Is there print even? Do they
even
still print the paper?
Print. They have print.
No, it was online. It was in the middle of the day yesterday.
You're gonna get us in trouble.
No, I'm not. It was in the middle of the day it happened. It was on their website.
They corrected it in Mountain Time.
They eventually, yes, exactly. If you subtract the hour, they corrected it immediately. That's exactly right. No, the best one was the Dallas Morning News endorsing Sadler for the U.S. Senate. Robert Deckard's Dallas Morning News.
How
endorsed
that?
A Democrat for the U.S. Senate, and then the next morning, big text caught on fire, and as you know, I think those things are completely related. It has to have happened. One begat the other.
Do any of these, other than big text catching on fire, obviously, do any of these things really matter?
Oh, no.
They matter in they really matter is in judicial races, because nobody's heard of people, and you know, if you get an endorsement in a newspaper in a judicial race,
your name ID goes.
It's actually worth some votes. And, you know, people are looking to the newspaper and saying, okay, I know I'm going to vote in the top race. I know I'm going to vote in the second race. What's this other thing?
But where's the inflection point? So judicial races, yes. So the San Antonio Express News.
I think it probably matters in legislative races.
That's what I was going to say. So San Antonio Express News endorses Philip Cortez over
John Garza.
Or the Houston Chronicle endorses Ann Johnson over Sarah Davis. These are two Democratic challengers to Republican incumbents endorsed by their hometown papers.
I think it's worth a couple of points potentially in races where some of the candidates have name ID problems. Now, Republicans will tell you with a fair amount of evidence that it doesn't necessarily help a Republican candidate, and in fact, the newspaper's endorsement may be a counterindicator.
You remember during the 2010 Republican primary, they polled that.
If you're Sarah Davis and the Houston Chronicle endorses Ann Johnson, you might go, good.
Yeah, that liberal media supported my...
That's, of course, the paper that endorsed both Romney and Cruz.
They did endorse Romney and Cruz. Right. So this is interesting. So Houston and Fort Worth in 2008 endorsed Obama. This year, they both endorsed Romney.
But Fort Worth...
San Antonio in 2008 endorsed McCain, and this year they endorsed Obama.
I sort of feel like the Star Telegram endorsement of Romney sort of reads like John Roberts writing the dissent for the healthcare decision and then switching sides and going the other way.
What do you mean?
You think there was a coup at the editorial board?
The way it's written is really... They list a long, an overly generous list of Obama's accomplishments and then say... But Romney has a good campaign theme, so let's go with that.
Do you remember in 2010, there were two newspapers that I recall that endorsed Rick Perry in the governor's race. I don't remember if it was the primary or the general. There was one of them, I think actually Kay got all the endorsements in the primary, so it may have been the general. Midland and Waco, I think, both endorsed Perry, but the Midland one in particular was super... like non-enthusiastic. It was like, oh God, please, if only Bill White would give us a reason to endorse him, we would, but he hasn't. Perry's not been good, but oh my God, if White would just give us one reason to endorse him, but he didn't, we endorsed Perry. And the Fort Worth one was kind of like that for Romney. But again, who cares? Is there a single person in the city of Fort Worth, not to pick on Fort Worth, is there a single person in any of these cities who is going to go, you know what? I am undecided. An election day is around the corner. Let's see what the pair. Oh, the Star-Telegram told me to vote for Romney. I will vote for Romney.
I just don't see it. I think there's only one form of indecision that's still important at this point
in an election.
It's the only people who haven't decided whether to vote. I think everybody's decided
whether
how they'll vote.
Whether to vote.
I think they've
that's
decided
it.
How they will vote if they vote. But I think some people are in that, you know, sitting, it's comfortable here on the couch. I might not get up. I'm not that excited, and I think that's really where the numbers could change.
Let's spend the rest of the podcast talking about all the things that you'd rather not do.
There could be lines. It could take a while.
The ballot was long. I voted early. The Travis County ballot with all the city stuff and school boards and everything was like 12 screens of a...
All the propositions.
E-reader.
You know, I think that we're getting to a point where the newspapers have to decide what their role is. Because clearly these endorsements, I think, are not... I just think it's the case. It's not moving the needle. And why do them? Aren't we moving into an era in which not endorsing might be a better branding piece for the newspapers?
Well, you can make the argument, too, that the newspapers ought to be more partisan. They ought to be more like they used to be back in the day.
So rather,
they
should endorse every day. We endorse turkey over tuna.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what I was wondering.
The Sherman Democrat was a Democratic paper. They endorsed Democrats back in the day. Now they're...
Hence the name.
Right.
And
it's like the Chattanooga Free Press has the sort of dueling opinion pages.
It's like blogs. It's like cable news networks. You know where they are.
Oh, God,
but how much of these endorsements do you think... I mean, it seems like they're most interesting for the... sort of window into the psychology of the editorial boards on the papers, right?
Yeah.
How much of it is just sort of making sure you back the winning candidate? I mean, that's almost what the Houston Chronicle says in their endorsement of Cruz. They say that, you know, we like Sadler okay, but honestly, his party is pretty weak, so we don't think he's going to get elected. Let's go with Cruz. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, that's pretty weak tea.
I mean, how much of this is going to be on the winning side?
I think it's nervier of the papers that are endorsing Sadler, because look, we all have said for weeks there's not, you know, an asteroid would have to land on Ted Cruz and kill him for Sadler to win this race. And the fact is, the Dallas News.
Well, as we've discussed with the unfortunate situation in the Senate,
Senator Gallegos,
that's not even a sure thing.
In fact, Cruz might still win, right? The fact is, though, that the Dallas News endorsing Sadler, I just can't figure out what the upside for them. They must really not like Cruz.
They must not like him. Maybe, you know, and they might have just wanted to start an argument over, you know, the argument in that race, and this is Sadler's point, but he has a bit of a point here. The argument in that race has been over viability and electability and not over the substance of their campaigns.
Right. We've all dismissed him out of hand and dismissed his chance out of hand because his party is dead, therefore he can't win.
The whole conversation in the press and outside the press has been, you know, is this guy viable? Isn't this guy the winner? Isn't that guy the winner? Instead of this one believes X, that one believes Y. If you agree with this one, vote for him. If you agree with that one, vote for him.
But the problem is, and this is not a knock on Sadler, but the problem is what Sadler... Or Sandler, for that matter. What Sandler believes... is not believed by enough people in the state for him to get elected. It is actually about what he believes and viability. Those things are contracted.
This is where you kind of slide into the money problem. If Sadler had the money to make his views as well known as Cruz has been able to make his views, would it be a more even race, or would, as you say, it still be lopsided because most people don't agree with Sadler?
Tony Sanchez spent $68 million to get the same percentage of the vote that candidates who spent nothing got. I'm not certain that money is a determining factor in victory or defeat.
And the number is 43.
Roughly, right.
You're a Democrat, you get
43. At least not in a general
election. Right.
Could it sway more in a primary?
So I'm waiting to see where this, you know, this is. So this is a parlor game, basically. In essence, what
the
endorsements are
is always a parlor game.
They're a parlor game.
This is a parlor.
Ooh, the Dallas Morning News endorsed a Democrat for the U.S. Senate. You know, dogs and cats are getting an apartment together. Whoever would have believed it, right? I'm waiting to see what the Statesman does, because you remember historically the Dallas Morning News has been the establishment, which you can interpret to mean the conservative newspaper. Again, Robert Decker, does that family. It's a conservative paper, small c or big c, depending upon how you see it. The idea that they endorse a Democrat is news. The Statesman has always been perceived to be the liberal paper, in quotes. It's Austin, it's, you know, hippies and Eeyore's birthday and crap like that. And lately, the Statesman has actually begun to be
Eeyore's birthday fans, send your emails to Evan.
That's right. But the Statesman, it wasn't a qualitative judgment on that. The Statesman has become more conservative incrementally over time, in that they actually have endorsed Rick Perry in the general, right? I mean, they've done more conservative stuff on the editorial page. They, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the Statesman endorsed either Romney or Cruz.
Editorial pages belong,
they may very well.
Editorial pages belong to publishers and not to journalists. And the editorial position of any newspaper, I think, has as much to do, and this is historically true, has as much to do with its commercial interests as with its political ideology. And I just don't think that they're that interesting. I think they've got a sort of a commercial conflict of interest built into this thing. I'm not sure that people follow publishers as pillars and leaders of their communities in the same way that they did 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And, you know, I just don't pay that much attention to them. I don't think most people do.
Well, I think to the earlier point that they're much more interesting on the local races, you mm-hmm. know, when people don't necessarily know who the candidates are.
Right, right.
And maybe on issues, although we don't know. San Antonio Express News came out very heavily for the pre-K initiative that Mayor Castro is pushing on the ballot in San Antonio. Statesman came out pretty heavily in favor of the medical school.
Right.
In Austin, which is a big deal on the ballot. You know, I don't know if those things have any sway. Certainly the people who support the medical school and pre-K are trumpeting those endorsements as significant. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. We're just, there's no way to actually know whether they're significant.
Yeah. Oh, you know, a good race to watch the effect of these on, just because, and it's a particular kind of race in a particular place on the ballot with a particular lack of money, is watch the presiding judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals race between Sharon Keller and Keith Hampton, which is almost entirely dependent on how the two of them do in editorial boards and on bar polls around the state.
And everyone has endorsed Hampton so far.
Well, right. And then you've got
every major paper. I don't think a single major paper has endorsed Sharon Keller, and I still think Sharon Keller probably wins.
So watch your number. If your number is 43, if the statewide Democrats' default number is 43, if Hampton outperforms that, then maybe you have to attribute some of that to bar polls and then some of these other kinds of things. Editorial endorsements, whatever.
If you guys are offering up either not endorsing or becoming more partisan as the sort of alternatives for more viability of this sort of behavior, is that just sort of a lose-lose for the papers?
Well, I don't know. If you were starting a thing up right now, would you decide, what would be the conversation? Do we endorse or do we not endorse? I don't really see an argument for endorsing. People don't pay attention to it. It just colors the rest of what you do.
It's suspicions confirmed for half the population.
Right. Whichever way you go. Oh, we knew you guys were blank. Right. I just don't think that's the way people get their information now. And I don't think that they come to the newspaper and say, well, you guys have been studying this and you're smart people. What do you think? That's not how it works.
And the Hampton race will be our test for that.
I think it changes as you go down the ballot
more so than the Cruz-Sandler race.
Right.
Definitely.
If right. there are any write-in votes for Sandler, I think that's pretty telling.
I'm going to write an Adam Sandler.
you do a
I think that funny Hanukkah song on the floor of the U.S. Senate would be awesome.
That would be awesome. That'd be pretty great.
Well, let's move along to Kate's topic now. Yeah, Ross, you're
supposed
to jump in there.
And now for something upbeat.
Yeah. It's been raining a lot. I still have mud on my jeans from ACL.
I'm sorry.
But Kate is here to bring us down. I think with regards to what that
if you got that at Zucker Park, it's probably not mud.
That's yes, true. Everybody here seems to be trying to run me out of a job because they say, "Oh, the drought's over." And what do I say, Reeve?
You say, "I want to stay employed."
What she says, she says, "Frack you," is what she says. There's plenty of other things to write about.
We are still in drought. More than half the state, more than 60% of the state, in fact, is still in drought.
Even us here in the Tribcast recording room are still in a drought.
Yes, a drought of good things to talk about. And anyway, the worst drought category, Texas has about 3% in the worst drought category, whereas a year ago it was like up in the 70s. So we're doing much better. And but you know, it's still a real problem. I mean, our lakes around Austin, people think, you know, like you, Reeve, oh, it has rained and we are fine. But
it's like in my head.
Yes, the lakes around Austin.
Oh, it has rained.
Yes, that must be a song. So, the lakes around Austin are still 44% full, which is, you know, way lower than than normal. But they're probably going to release. They may well release water to the rice farmers next year. That's the sort of new thing they're not going to recommend against. Sort of an emergency measure to prevent that. So then they drop further, and people around the Highland Lakes get even more upset.
So the first level issue is whether anybody down the Colorado River gets water, rice farmers and such.
Yeah, that's a big slug of water.
How full do the lakes have to be to not be considered drought? They don't have to be all the way to 100, do they?
Well, no. I mean, and most of these reservoirs around Texas aren't built to be, you know, completely full. But there's certainly, I mean, normally at this time of year, much fuller than 44%. I mean, I think it's somewhere in the 60s, 70s.
I was going to ask, where do they get comfortable? Where do the engineers relax?
I don't know.
45%?
I'm just going to make up something here. But yes, exactly. I would go in the sort of 60s, 70s or something.
What's the trend line right now? Are we at least
improving? We're stable. We're stable. I mean, all that rain, you know, we were 44% before all the rain. So, yeah. But the good news is for West Texas, it's really brought the lake levels up. They were within like a year of running out of water from their big lake. I mean, West Texas stores all this water on the surface, which is, you know, in these reservoirs, kind of a problem because so much evaporates. You know, they evaporate more than they use. And San Antonio actually has a system of storing some water in an aquifer underground.
Wait, so back up. They evaporate more than they use?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they're
water. We should change that policy.
Right.
the doctrinaire draconian water restrictions, more accurately, that they put into effect out there are now being lifted, or they're still in effect? What's the story with it?
Well, I mean, San Angelo was just in the process of banning all outdoor watering, and then it rained, and they were like, oh, nope. You know, I think they've got now a restriction of maybe a couple days a week, which is pretty standard. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, either it rains or it, you know, rains, it pours, it fills up the reservoirs, or it's really dry. I mean, West Texas just sort of ping-pongs between those two.
Yeah.
But, you know, going forward, I mean, you know, with all the oil activity out there, you know, West Texas is where this water issue really comes to a head, because it's just so dry, and it's all this economic activity out there.
So we have this water conference. We're doing a day-long program at Texas State on Monday. It's kind of a mini Texas Tribune Festival. We have a lot of great people, Speaker Strauss and Chairman Ritter and Senator Hager and former Senator Averitt, Commissioner Staples and Laura Huffman from the Nature Conservancy, Carolyn Britton from the Water Development Board, Andy Sansom, who is, if there's a Mount Rushmore of water in Texas, he's like Roosevelt, you know. My question, though, is maybe the problem is solved. Maybe we should just cancel the thing on Monday. I can have my day back. Is that right? Because now it sounds like everything's okay.
Well, I mean, we're a growing population, and water is the one thing that Texas can't just build more of. You know, we can build more power
plants. We didn't build that.
Right.
It's kind of the message, right?
Well, the current line, I heard Ritter talk a couple of days ago. The current line is that if you fully funded the Texas water plant, it's around $53 billion.
Yeah.
And he pointed out that, you know, in 1981, we ran the numbers. The engineers ran the numbers and said, here's how much water you need. And Texas voters turned down what then sounded expensive but now sounds really cheap. And the numbers turned out to be right. So we still got the problem.
Well, but there's also
even when you're not in drought, you've got to have a water plan.
The subtext of this, which I think we will talk about actually on Monday, and I think Andy Sansom will talk about it particularly, he's going to kick off the day and set the context for the entire program, is we have a $53 billion unfunded water plan, only we don't have the money to pay for it, and it may be the wrong plan. The idea is that the plan essentially assumes you can engineer your way out of the problem. You acquire a bunch of land, you acquire a bunch of right-of-way, and you build a whole lot of reservoirs and then see you at the Christmas party. When in fact, it may be that technology as opposed to engineering is the solution. Desal plants, et cetera, et cetera. That a lot of the more voguish methods of dealing with water of the last couple of years may really trump the assumption that this is something we can build our way out of. And so I think that's an interesting conversation. And going into the session, the question will be, is all the activity on the legislative side going to be, let's just stick to the plan that we passed a couple of years ago, or let's reexamine whether that's the right plan going forward?
But even technology costs money, right?
Right. I don't think it's a question of cost as much as, are we going to spend $53 billion on the right thing or something that's so 5 years ago?
Well, I think there are questions. Are we going to spend, you know, actually pony up and spend money? I mean, that's something the state has seems to have a lot of trouble doing.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, yeah, Strauss has said, you know, it's going to be a strong water session. So, you know, we'll see what that actually means. But also, you know, conservation. I mean, that's kind of, you know, can be a touchy word because people like the freedom to water their lawn as much as they want.
It's tough politics. It's like getting people to pay for dieting or putting money aside for retirement. It's one of those things where, you know, yeah, I know I need to take care of this, but it's not any fun today. And politics is all, you know, based on right now. And, you know, if you have one candidate saying you don't have to do that and one candidate saying you do, you'll go with the one that says you don't have to do it. That's how voters react. I mean, it's a real political trap. It's hard to do long-term stuff.
And is it a matter of, I mean, everyone's going to have to change their expectations of what their water usage will be in the future?
Well, I mean, I don't think we can continue to sort of grow at the rate that Texas wants to grow and also all have great lawns. I mean,
I don't water my lawn.
You have a lawn?
I'm moving houses. I have a huge backyard now, which I will not water. I promise you, Kate.
Will you put in xeriscaping?
No. That's up to the landlord.
Okay, so that dry brown patch in the middle of Austin, that'll be Reeves' house. Very popular with the neighbors, I'm sure.
All right.
Anything else you're expecting to see at the water conference?
Well, it's going to be a discussion of funding. I think that part of what we'll hear more about on Monday and what we'll hear more about in the next session is whether this is a cost that the state needs to incur itself or whether the cost is going to be distributed among the state, counties, cities, and frankly, private folks. You know, these days in education, you hear a lot about how the state and the cities and the counties can't pay for everything, and so we do a lot of public-private partnerships, which is code for, we're not paying for it on the public side, you guys got to pony up on the private side to make everything whole.
And actually, the conference here is a good example of that, right? Just because of the Meadows Foundation coming in to prop up the water research
Used to be the River Systems Institute, now it's the Meadows Center, and the Meadows Foundation made a significant gift to support the work of Andy and the others at the River Systems Institute in doing research on water, all the many issues related to water. And that is an example of a foundation stepping in and providing resources to a public institution because the public institution's resources are down from what they were once upon a time.
But having a center is a little bit sexier than having, like, the AT&T reservoir.
Wow.
Right. Maybe they'll sponsor
them all. We'll discuss that idea next week.
your company logo on the bottom of this leg.
I'm not sure that the water would taste any worse if AT&T's logo was on the glass. I got to tell you, it's water.
When you
describe a funding plan for public policy as sexy, I expect you to do it in your Barry White voice.
I don't actually have a
I'm
Barry
glad
White
you think
voice.
Water can be sexy, Reeve.
No, my argument was that it can't.
Oh.
The higher ed camp. That's what I was saying.
This is just all going to crap, isn't it? This whole podcast.
He's the moderator.
What else do we have to talk about today?
Oh, we're going to talk about school finance lawsuits. Ross was going to update us.
They started this week, and, you know, the most depressing thing about this is if you ask everybody how long this is going to take, the trial, the presentation of information is going to take from October 22nd when it started, maybe into January. So shortly after that, we're supposed to get a decision from, or there's an expectation we'll get a decision from John Dietz, the state district judge. And if that goes against the state, as most of the lawyers expect it will, there'll be a direct appeal to the Texas Supreme Court, and you'll get a decision in sometime after the legislative session. So it gives the legislature a perfectly good reason, which they have availed themselves of before, to not do anything really dramatic with the budget and just say, you know, let's wait and see what school finance does. So if you're looking for tax reform or you're looking for any kind of real funding reform or any, you know, frankly, some of these big plans like water, transportation, some of those kinds of things, there's an easy way for the easy mechanism here for the legislature to say, you know, let's wait and see what the courts say on school finance. But the immediate depressing prospect is that this trial is just going to drag
out
all the way through the holidays.
Well, they're dealing with,
six different lawsuits consolidated into one. The basic line of these is that the state doesn't provide equal funding to each of its school districts, that it doesn't provide adequate funding to its school districts, that the state cap on local property taxes is a de facto statewide property tax, which is unconstitutional, and that the state ought to allow more charter schools than it does in order to help alleviate some of these problems. And that's kind of where the lawsuits are focused.
All I care about is how soon before Ken Herman writes a column that contains the word God is in the Dietz-tails. That's really all I care about.
But John Dietz, get it? Yeah.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
You don't think that's hilarious? I think that's
I definitely thought it was an interesting observation. I'm glad you made it.
I got to drop Ken Herman's name in the podcast so we get retweeted.
That's right.
Yeah, I guess so. You've totally derailed the podcast with that Ken
Just
Herman
talk like
reference.
Barry White. It will all be fine.
So basically just don't hope for anything. Water, schools.
Well, I just think, you know, if the
can is more likely, the school finance can is more likely to be kicked down the proverbial road than water.
This isn't even cynical. I mean, it's just sort of observing the way they've done with school finance before. If the legislature is in some need to raise money for schools, they generally don't do it except under court order. So when the courts come back with one of these school finance suits and say, you know, you got to spend more, you got to spend it differently, that becomes the mechanism for a legislature, which has been conservative over the years, even when it wasn't Republican, to say, well, I don't want to raise your taxes, but the courts may
be. They made me twisting, do it. They put a gun to our heads.
They're twisting my arm behind my back. Everybody in the legislature, right. Virtually everybody, I haven't talked to anybody in the legislature who thinks that the state's going to win this lawsuit. Or any of these lawsuits. And so the issue becomes how.
Although Morgan said the lawyer for the Attorney General's office was kind of a butt kicker, that she was pretty tough.
Well, and there's some question about this Supreme Court and whether this Supreme Court is, you know, significantly different from its predecessors and will say, in fact, you know, the state's right. But most of the legislators are assuming that they're going to lose this lawsuit in some fashion. And they want to see how they lose it and what that means for state funding before they get too far down the road with any kind of big changes in state funding or any kind of new big commitments. You know, if you commit to a new this or a new that, and all of a sudden school finance comes in and it's expensive, then you've got, you know, a giant mess on your hands.
It's an
easy mechanism for kicking it down
the road. I would second what Ross said about the number of legislators, and it's not every legislator, but it's a number of them in the building who probably in their hearts wanted to put more money into public aid, whether it was fully funded or not, but more than they did, and who at this point would love to be able to tell their people back home, the court made us do it. I know that it's, you know, I couldn't do it politically, but legally I've got no choice now. And they're thinking to themselves privately, whew, I can finally do what I really believe was right, even though politically it was untenable.
Wasn't me, sweetie. It was Wallace Jefferson and Nathan Hecht. So.
Blame them.
Does that mean we're going to have a special session when the decision comes in then?
That's generally how this has gone.
Yeah. So don't make vacation plans. Next June. Where are you going to be?
Next summer?
Yeah.
I'll be in France.
Will you be?
Yeah. Wow. Riding
a water situation there.
That's delicious.
Trey Bunn.
Wine.
Exactly. They have a wine shortage.
It's all red and tastes like grapes.
Exactly. All right, friends, you wrap this up.
All right. Well, if you have questions or comments about that, any final comments from you guys before
I like Kate. I think Kate adds a certain something to the podcast. I'd like to have her back.
Yeah,
even though I sound like an old person.
She definitely popped a lot of, you know, balloons that were hoping to end the drought.
I call you mature. Not old. Mature.
If you have any thoughts on that or any other
Ross,
issue,
however, sounds old.
The email
Get off my
is
lawn.
tribcast@texasjournal.org.
Get off my unwatered lawn.
My dry, crusty lawn.
On behalf of Evan, Ross, Kate, Todd, and Dry, Crusty Lawns
Todd,
everywhere.
Todd is the lead singer in Dry, Crusty Lawn, actually. Yeah. It's a hell of a band.
Sort of a metal kind of band.
It is. Yeah. It's opening for Horses and Bayonets this week.
This is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Hello.
We're Larry King.
Dayton, Ohio. Hello.